It's beginning to feel like a very real crisis between Washington and Jerusalem. Internally in Israel, a real crisis shaking Netanyahu's government. And we say goodbye to a real mensch, a politician who went where no Jewish American politician went before. It's Unholy. I'm Yanit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London. It's Unholy, two Jews on the news, and the news that broke overnight just before you and I sat down to talk to each other is this death at age 82 of former Senator Joe Lieberman of the United States, represented Connecticut in the Senate. I immediately have to say a very personal memory popped into my head, which is of Simchat Torah in Kesher Israel Synagogue in Washington, D.C., I'm going to guess 1994, possibly the following year, where, you know, I was taking part and dancing around the scroll, as you are required to do, you know, in that style where you have one hand on the shoulder of the person in front of you and one hand behind, and realized that the person whose shoulder I had my hand on was the senator from Connecticut, Joe Lieberman. And he and I were then in that whole thing of going round in the circle, then you have to hold hands for a bit, then you're back in. And, you know, all I'm thinking is, of course, I must ask him a question. I'm a young reporter in Washington, and he's a senator. What can I think of? And in the end, you just did that, the sort of, I just did the smiling awkwardly, as you do in forced dancing. But I did talk to him at some other point, and then about being Orthodox and Jewish and walking to the Senate on some Saturday morning votes and all of that stuff. That was long before the big splash he made, which was, of course, in 2000, when Al Gore nominated him to be, if he'd won, the first Jewish vice president in American history.
Yeah, just a few hundred votes in Florida stood between us and the first Jewish vice president in history. You know, a good friend of the podcast who's just reached 30 wrote me this message this morning. He said he meant so much to the soul of American Jews. I think that's very accurate about Joe Lieberman. You know, it was, I think, for many years kind of universally understood, maybe sadly, that a Jew would not ever be president. And he was the closest we got to it. Thus far, I think that there's also this sort of sense that he was quite a mensch. Obviously, his political career is a very interesting one. You know, he left the Democratic Party and he stood for John McCain and not for Barack Obama. Just the whole issue of the three amigos. We know this story very well. This is my Joe Lieberman story. You're always going to outdo me. But I kind of remember three of them standing on stage. It was like a stand-up performance that I saw in the Saban Forum more than a decade ago. Him, Lindsey Graham, and John McCain, who are very, very close friends. It says something about the ability to be friends even through disagreements. And, you know, I remember even then thinking how nostalgic this is to an era of politics we don't see anymore, that attempt to sort of work across the aisle. So yes, this is what happened, as you said, just a few hours ago. And it is quite sad to learn about the passing of Joe Lieberman. Lindsey Graham, the only one still alive out of the three, wrote this tweet. You know, he said, rest in peace. He wrote to Hadassah, his wife, that there are so many people who love you dearly. And he kind of ended it with the words from the last amigo. So that's something. We want to maybe play a clip of him, of Joe Lieberman.
We should. I mean, I was just going to say, you mentioned his wife, Hadassah. I remember, I think I wrote a piece somewhere saying, it wasn't just that Joe Lieberman was Jewish. He was so Jewish that the second lady was going to be called literally Hadassah. I mean, imagine an Hadassah in the White House. And he was just, you know, really out there Jewishly, and famously used to walk to Capitol Hill if there were votes on Shabbat. He didn't wear a kippah, which I think is interesting because he did define himself as Orthodox. He broke, obviously, from many Democrats in supporting the Iraq War and defending it. Broke, actually, from Al Gore, who did oppose it in that period. And, you know, he was pretty hawkish and alienated Democrats a lot.
and became increasingly hawkish as the years went by, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so that's why, in a way, the bipartisan thing stopped being that bipartisan, because he was basically a Republican by the end. But he, you know, he was made a big name nationally when he did that very moral speech against Bill Clinton over the Monica Lewinsky affair. Again, I felt that was a Jewish intervention. There is a particular kind of way Jews are heard in a political life and in American life. And it sort of it had weight because he was a man of faith, and he's, you felt his Jewish sensibility was coming in. I remember at the time people were saying, you know, this, there was a sort of hint of Old Testament wrath in Joe Lieberman's censuring of Bill Clinton, you know, whatever you make of that. The point is, very Jewish. And so the bit we're going to hear is Joe Lieberman on the day that Al Gore announced him as his running mate in 2000.
There are some people who might actually call Al's selection of me an act of chutzpah. I cannot express with words the gratitude that I feel in my heart today as the first Jewish American to be honored to be a major party candidate for the vice presidency of this blessed United States of America of ours.
That was Joe Lieberman in 2000. I think one of his recent remarks, one of his last remarks, was to criticize Chuck Schumer for what he said against Netanyahu, saying that it was the wrong thing to do, paraphrasing him, to interfere in Israeli politics. Very active in that regard until his last days.
And he obviously would have had a lot to say about what we're going to be talking about. As you said at the top of the episode, any attempt to pretend there isn't a ever widening gap between Washington and the government in Jerusalem needs to rethink, because the tension is all out there and in the open to see this really important step this week, which was the United States withholding its veto at the UN Security Council. We are so used to Washington, the United States, throwing a protective arm around Israel at the UN by vetoing any hostile resolution that comes Israel's way. And they did not do that this week. Instead, they abstained on the resolution that was before the Security Council, which called for an immediate ceasefire and also the release of the hostages, but did not condemn Hamas. That's why the Americans said that they abstained rather than voted for it. But it now means it is, as it were, sort of the policy of the world community that this fighting must stop. And that was in defiance of what Israel wanted, and says what we've been saying has been building. We've been talking about it for months and months and months, which is, this is not a joke. Joe Biden and Netanyahu are, you know, parting in a big way. And that means Israel and is in a state of great tension with its most important strategic ally.
Yes, and that is extremely dangerous, particularly for Israel. But as you say, this is a signal, at the very least, a signal that the Biden administration is losing patience with the way that Netanyahu is running this war. The result, what surprised the Biden administration, was the response by Netanyahu himself, which decided to cancel the meeting, which was a personal request of President Biden, for the two sort of top advisors of Netanyahu himself, Dermer and Tzachi Hanegbi, to come to Washington and show essentially the plans for an operation in Rafah. Now, that meeting has been reinstated since, but the fact that the Israeli prime minister, while the American president is giving billions to Israel to assist and protect Israel in this war, is, I think it was the Washington Post who called it Israel doubling down on defiance. This is a decision. It is a strategic decision made by Netanyahu himself that has its own internal logic that I assume that we will go into, but it definitely puts the entire relationship under this very, very heavy shadow.
You know, friend of the podcast, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman says that Netanyahu will be remembered not only as the worst leader in Israel's history, but one of the worst leaders in Jewish history. And one of the reasons he says that is because common consensus for decades in Israel that its number one strategic asset was not this weapon or that weapon, but was the relationship with the US. And over a long period, years actually, Netanyahu has set about damaging that relationship. he think we'll get onto the internal logic, but it plays well for him to be seen defying America or whatever. But that is, he is almost methodically weakening something which Israel has relied on. You know, me and others, I and others for a long time have been warning, been saying that if Israel persists on the course that Netanyahu is taking it on, what awaits it is some kind of, you know, leper status, pariah status. And that I thought was something in the distance. You see a week like this week when the entire, you know, UN Security Council, 14 voting for and one abstention, Russia, China, and the United States in effect on the same page, you know, at odds with the government of Israel. This is what isolation looks like. It's not a threat in the future. It's here. And this is wholly down to the actions of Netanyahu. So, you know, it's on him.
Look, I will say this. The fact that Israel, mere 6 months ago, went through the worst massacre in its history and is now, we are 6 months after, and you have this decision by the UN. You have people like, you know, Joe Rogan, who's not exactly a lefty, talking about Israel's genocide in Gaza to his 11 million followers. You have The Economist with its cover page saying Israel alone. It, of course, is also the international community and the way it's judging Israel in a way that other countries aren't ever judged. But it is also something that we should say about the way this government has been running the war. Now, this is not particularly the topic this week of our podcast, but it's definitely a question to be, you know what, it's not the topic this week, it's been the topic for the 6 months. It is a question to be asked. We talked about the logic of what Netanyahu is doing. Just a, you know, a memo to our American listeners, when you want to try and realize where the internal logic is. Netanyahu, it's always easy to say, okay, he's trying to show he's a tough guy to his own base, and maybe this is a way to deflect from the fact that he's actually concerned of what can happen to the rest of the war, and it would be a good thing to, you know, blame the Americans. All of that is an explanation, but read what the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal said this week, right? It says, of course, against President Biden. And it says, if Mr. Biden thinks his escalating fight with Israel is risk-free, think again. The Harvard-Harris poll finds that 63% of voters in the United States support a ceasefire only after Hamas releases hostages and is removed from power. This is what Netanyahu is cashing in on. It's not only a message internally for Israelis, it's also a message that he is trying to send across the Atlantic to the, particularly maybe Republicans, but also to say, look, most of the American public is with me on this. Again, there are different polls on this. And as we said, it is a very difficult thing to not see the mounting criticism against Israel. I think it is also for people who even disagree with Joe Biden inside the United States. These signals of another leader disrespecting the president is something that I think a lot of Americans would find distasteful.
Well, let's say that is his thinking and that's his logic. For one thing, I think it rests on a very faulty premise. There is conflicting polling evidence. Gallup this week saying that only 36% of Americans approve of Israeli military action in Gaza, down from 50 in November, and actually 55% disapprove. So now big majority against what Israel is doing. But even if he was right and there was a, you know, a popular support there among Americans, what does he think is going to happen? That he's going to play this constituency, build it up, and see Biden lose in November, making way for Donald Trump? Don't bet on Donald Trump being your ally. We got a very clear message from Trump himself this week saying how he sees things, and it's not that different from Joe Biden. We can hear that.
You have to finish up your war. You have to finish it up. You got to get it done. And we got to get to peace. You can't have this going on. And I will say, Israel has to be very careful because you're losing a lot of the world. You're losing a lot of support. 15 years ago, Israel had the strongest lobby. You couldn't say, if you were a politician, you couldn't say anything bad about Israel. It would be like the end of your political career. Today, it's almost the opposite. Look, Israel has to get better with the promotional and with the public relations, because right now they're really, you know, they're being hurt very badly, I think, in a public relations sense.
Yeah, that's Trump too, in an interview to Israel Hayom, the Israeli daily newspaper. As you say, even if the gamble is to bet on Trump being elected, and that is the gamble Netanyahu is making. He thinks that it would be better He would tell you for Israel. Some would say it's better for him. In any case, that will not happen until January of 2025. In the meantime, there is an American president that has shown in every way his support in Israel, coming here physically during the war, if I'm not mistaken, this weekend, signing off on $3.8 billion in aid to Israel. Look, this is Netanyahu's tactic. It has been his tactic with Barack Obama as well. Then the argument was the Iran deal and not a war in Gaza, but it was the same tactic. The tactic was to stand up to the American president, to convince Israelis the American president doesn't have their interests in heart. It was easier for him to do across from when Barack Obama was president for all kinds of reasons we shouldn't get into. Again, it's harder for him to do it now, A, because he's markedly weaker as a leader in this country because of the war, and secondly, because it's very difficult to convince Israelis after everything they've seen in the past 6 months that Joe Biden doesn't have a lot of their best interests in his heart.
Look, far be it from me to ever agree with Donald Trump. You know, it sticks somewhere in my...
Listeners, please write the time and date that this is happening. Yes, continue, Jonathan.
But when he said there about, you know, you're losing friends, you're losing support, I think that is the picture. You mentioned some very good examples before, you know, symbolic, totemic things that economists cover and so on. But it's happening around the world. And I just mentioned, as an example, a sort of straw in the wind, but Ireland, you know, small country, but it wants to join the case at the International Court of Justice that brought by South Africa against Israel, the former prime minister, now foreign minister, Michael Martin, saying that Ireland's going to join that case to argue that the definition of genocide should include, be changed to include a pattern of behavior that impedes humanitarian aid. And he said, "We've experienced famine. We know what it's like in our psyche." This is happening, by the way, where countries are asserting a kind of moral authority, South Africa with its experience of apartheid, now Ireland saying we've experienced famine. And those countries in the global south particularly, you can see what's forming here, which is a sort of alliance of countries that I've would argue that they have suffered from through history, through colonialism, etc., branding Israel. You know, we saw it straight after October the 7th as this settler colonial entity. It's all of a piece, but, you know, you can always find a reason to dismiss this or that, say it's only Ireland, they're a small country, and so on. This is a pattern, and in his own way, and this will be a rare moment of agreement with him, that was identified there by Donald Trump. And, you know, the warning lights are not just flashing, they are now solid red, because with that moment is here. It's not now a distant prospect. It's here.
Yeah, I think it is, again, important to emphasize that no country has been as harshly checked, turned over, examined as Israel has been. The tide has definitely turned against it for a few reasons, but we should also say that we hear many more voices castigating Israel than we do of actually people saying, you know, Israel has been very careful, actually, in dealing with urban warfare in a kind of war that has... that we've never seen like it in this, how difficult it is in this, you know, underground tunnels that run longer than the New York subway system, and how to fight this kind of war. It's definitely also down to the way that the Israeli government is running this war. But we cannot forget that a lot of it also is due to the way the world sees Israel to begin with. But I would want to...
I would just chip on that and say... I think that's right. The broad outline of what you said there is right. But I think it's interesting that the condemnation, just take this Ireland example, isn't about the urban warfare. You're not hearing the condemnation of that. There would be some people who would say they accept what you say about the way that aspect of the war. It's again and again and again on this humanitarian issue. So that's where Ireland intervening very specifically on food aid, rather than making all the other points about how Israel's conducted it.
Yes, well, it's particularly the issue of urban warfare, and serious people like John Spencer, who are experts on this, saying Israel is doing all that it can not to hurt civilians, essentially. Of course, the world saying the opposite. But I think we've been around this block a few times, you and I. I think we at least can agree on the fact that it is a combination of both things that have led Israel to the place that it is now. And just, you know, as an Israeli, I think that it's terribly, terribly tragic. And we are having this discussion while still there are 134 hostages being held by Hamas. It's very clear, by the way, everyone calling for a ceasefire, if Hamas had just let them out, we wouldn't even be in this discussion. I think that should also be mentioned at this time. A lot of questions, and by the way, officially the United States putting the blame on Hamas, so is Israel, of course. A lot of questions why this cannot move forward, because on paper, the differences and the gap don't seem to be that huge and that insurmountable. The question of course, the question of motivation. It's clear that Sinwar doesn't want that. Maybe he thinks that the world will stop Israel anyway, and he doesn't need a deal to stop the war. And there are murmurs inside the Israeli negotiating team saying Netanyahu himself is not overly motivated in this regard. I think that it is important to also read the words of Amit Sosana, who was abducted by Hamas and released, and what she is telling the New York Times about the sexual assault and what she went through, the first Israeli hostage to come back and tell her story. I think it underlines the urgency to get these people out. We know what they're going through. I think there's no more urgent mission for Israel and for the world.
Yeah, I agree with that. In terms of the hostage deal, it's really interesting. Those reports come out saying, when you see exactly as you say, the two positions, you think, well, this surely they're not that far apart. This could be bridged. In a way, I think you put your finger on it, though. It's about motivation. And, you know, somebody who's in business said to me, the problem is you have neither a willing buyer nor a willing seller, and therefore there's going to be no deal. And I think that's exactly right. Don't be looking at the exact sort of small print of the deal. The point is, Sinwar thinks it serves him for there not to be a deal. He's still waiting for the rest of the Arab world perhaps to join in its fight against Israel, or for the international community via that UN resolution and other things to pressure Israel. And on the other hand, for all the reasons we've talked about domestically, electorally, Netanyahu does not appear to be in any hurry for this war to end or for that deal to come through. So those are the two key people, and neither of them want it that much. And therefore, bleak and incredibly depressing, though it is, especially for the families of those hostages, I don't see an immediate prospect, because I don't see why the two people making the decision believe it is in their immediate and in some ways selfish interest for this deal to come together. Obviously, in saying that, you know, nobody is saying these two are the same or equivalent. There is a world of difference between the head of an elected government and a man who masterminded a massacre on October the 7th. World of difference. But my only point is there are competing interests in when you're trying to put together a deal. It has to be that both sides and their leaders think this serves them.
So, of course, the looming question above the war that is continuing, smaller scale, but still happening in Gaza, is the question of Rafah. Israel saying, if we don't have our hostages, this is the next step. The United States clearly not wanting this. But we hear messages after this very, you know, after it's very clear that there is a crisis between the two countries. John Kirby, National Security Council spokesperson, which I talked to this week, and it was very clear that he wanted to get the message across to Israelis through Israeli television. This is what he says about Rafah, and I think it's important to listen. It's not a categorical no. It's something a little more nuanced. Let's listen to that.
President Biden saying to Israel a categorical no, that the United States is opposed to any Rafah operation, or if you were shown any endorsable plan that includes addressing the humanitarian issue in a way that is acceptable to you, that would be possible.
You know, we just can't support a major ground offensive in Rafah that doesn't include, you know, a plan, an achievable, verifiable plan to take care, to look after the safety and security of the 1.5 million Gazans that have sought refuge there. Look, we recognize that there's a need to go after Hamas. We certainly recognize that Israel has a right to do that. Of course they do. Hamas still represents a viable threat. And we know that there are Hamas fighters in Rafah. And we absolutely understand the need to do that. But we don't believe that going in on the ground in Rafah is a good idea in a major way. That there are other ways to get after that threat. And that's why we were so looking forward to being able to have an Israeli delegation here this week to talk about some other ways to do that.
Look, I understand why, if you hold that up in a certain light, it looks like he's giving a bit more leeway to Israel, because he says not in a major way. There can't be a major ground incursion, as if to say there can be a smaller one. He's definitely showing understanding of why this would be an objective. And it's quite true that that hasn't been talked about much. People just talk about the threat of an Israeli operation in Rafah and then don't talk about why that might be something Israel needs or wants to do. But I still think he comes out saying, we get the reason, but we think this can be achieved other ways. So I don't think it's an amber light for an operation. I don't think it's certainly not a green light. I think he's just showing some empathy in saying why America is still showing a red light to a major operation. That's how I read that answer to you in that interview.
Yes, it is important for John Kirby to say, we of course think that Israel, of course we know that Israel is a sovereign state and can make its own decisions, but as you say, also lightly showing that the United States can show its dismay if this is the plan made by the Israeli government. I remind you of something we talked about last week. Netanyahu was saying there are parts of the Israeli politicians who are coordinating with the Americans to prevent me from entering Rafah, and it sounds like an alibi. And there are people who have been saying he is picking this fight with the United States because it's easier to do that than to actually continue the war and try to explain to the Israeli public why it isn't, as he calls it, a total victory. So that is where we are at this point in the war.
All of this goes on while Israeli politics goes on. And, you know, one of my obsessions has been, when will there come some challenge from within? We've been talking all about the challenge from without, from the United States. But there surely is domestic political pressure on Netanyahu from within, and particularly from even inside his own coalition. You alerted us to a possible danger at the start of the month. It is now pretty well the end of March. Where do we stand on the, what you then called, a ticking time bomb under the coalition? What is the time bomb and how loudly is it ticking?
Well, the time moved forward, which is very important. And of course, we have to say this is a real crisis. Before, when we were talking about Netanyahu betting on Trump being the president in the White House January 2025, I need to say to you, and I don't want to sound too dramatic, we don't know if Benjamin Netanyahu will be the prime minister then. This is indeed, as I sort of warned you at March 1st, this is indeed a real crisis. We are talking about the draft bill. We're going to have to pull back a little. Are you going to be patient with me while I take the scenic route on this one?
Always, always.
Good. This is what we are essentially talking about. It's the sort of, I think, convergence of coincidence and history. The bill that was in place that essentially gave the ultra-Orthodox in Israel an exemption from military service expired. It expired in the summer. There was a decision by the government to extend it, but now the Supreme Court has said you have a deadline until the end of March to get a new decision across. If you don't get a new decision, two things will happen. One, the thousands of students, ultra-Orthodox students of Torah in the yeshivot will be conscripted. And two, very importantly, there will be no funding anymore, government funding for these yeshivot. I also added then at the beginning of March, what was indeed the ticking bomb was Yoav Gallant himself, the defense minister, saying, and he's the one who's supposed to present the bill as the defense minister, I will not put forth a bill that the whole coalition won't agree on, knowing full well that the coalition that stretches from Benny Gantz to the ultra-Orthodox will never agree on a bill. Indeed, what the government tried to suggest to the Supreme Court has been deemed by the Attorney General Gali Baharav Miara yesterday at midnight as not a serious enough suggestion or draft proposal, and now saying, and this has never happened in the history of Israel, Netanyahu's government needs to prepare to enlist the ultra-Orthodox and to prepare, and the yeshivot themselves need to prepare for their funding being cut. This is extremely dramatic. Now, we will not see a policeman walking into the yeshivot and arresting people who should be drafted tomorrow, but it does stress the fact that, again, I will even pull back a little bit further if I can. Remember when the ultra-Orthodox entered Netanyahu's government and their dream was to finally and officially get a draft bill and write it the way they wanted, to be exempt from military service. And remember the logic that stood at the root of the judicial overhaul that said that this is why the ultra-Orthodox supported the judicial overhaul, to have an override clause if the Supreme Court would not allow them to get this bill. Now, we are in a reality in which Israel's at war. No one has the patience for this kind of exemption anymore, and the military does need soldiers. This is where history comes in and the importance of that. So right now, there is no bill that can be created that will be agreed upon by this government, that the Supreme Court will agree to, and time is running out. So the one thing, and we should mention just technically, Knesset is going to be out of session. There's no way to dissolve the Knesset now. It returns after Independence Day. This crisis will be in full throttle mode in May and June, but this is a real crisis in the Netanyahu government. It's not something you can gloss over. And there has been even talk that the ultra-Orthodox would actually say, you know what, to the opposition desperately wants elections, we'll go to elections and you give us a, whatever, 6-month extension in which we can somehow, you know, settle this story.
You know, you mentioned we're not going to see pictures of police turning up at yeshivot, at religious academies, demanding young men enlist there and then. It prompts a thought in me of this sketch, which went kind of pretty viral from the show. We talk about it often, the TV satiric satire show, Eretz Nederet, which is done really important work in these last 6 months. This sketch in which soldiers turn up at the door, very much as if about to break the ultimate and terrible news to the parent on the other side of the door. The door opens and it's somebody ultra-Orthodox there who says, you know, I feared this day would one day come. And it's absolutely the idiom that would be very familiar to Israeli families. And then the ultra-Orthodox man says, but I tell you, I'm not going to serve. Whatever happens, you'll never make me do it. It plays on exactly that difference, which is that most Israelis, all Israelis, Jewish Israelis who are not ultra-Orthodox, are compelled, age 18, to enlist and serve, and where the country is uniform, male or female, that is the rule. And it binds Israeli society together in a way that I think is not often understood outside. It's a massive thing. There is this exception, and you mentioned the history when it was devised. It was a compromise by David Ben-Gurion, the prime minister. I think he believed that religious Jews were almost, you know, if they weren't yet extinct, they were a vanishing species. That in the new Zion, he didn't do the math, but he thought in the new Zion, there would be no need for people to be ultra-Orthodox. They would become sort of the Hebrew nation instead and so on. They were 1% then. They are, what is the percentage? 13% or something mm-hmm. now. It's rising. And so you are dealing with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are in effect carried by the rest of the country, both in terms of military service, but also economic activity. So it's a really, really huge issue. And it just obviously has to be dealt with. Eventually, and it's, you know, it now has real sharpness after October the 7th because the country is united in feeling that there is a sacrifice that they are all making. And why is this one group outside that? I think it's an issue for the entire Jewish world. It's not, you know, in this country, 1 in 2 Jewish births are to Haredi, to ultra-Orthodox families. This is the future of the Jewish world in a major way. And whether they're in or out is a big, big question.
Yes, and again, it's the sort of convergence of coincidence in history, because this is a moment in which Israeli society is bleeding, soldiers are dying, there is a war. It makes this question all the more poignant, and it happens when the coincidence is that the law that was in place expired, and you have to have a new law. You know, so all of this is brewing. And when Benny Gantz suggested his own draft bill, the ultra-Orthodox wouldn't agree to it. What he said essentially is over 10 years, everyone will do some sort of service, military service or national service, the ultra-Orthodox and the Arab Israelis. He said to the ultra-Orthodox, this is the best deal you are going to get. That might be very, very true. And again, there's a very big question, you know, after the war, after the judicial overhaul, if the thing that will topple Netanyahu will be this. We are seeing, I had a friend in Washington ask me this week, who breaks down the government? Who's going to make the government collapse? I don't have an answer for that, but you do see the bricks beginning to fall. There's this, there's Gideon Saar leaving, there's the fight with the Biden administration. The bricks are falling, and this is becoming something that you cannot ignore. This is a real crisis.
So the larger point I was just going to make was this thing about the time, the expiration date on the Netanyahu premiership, and the idea that, you know, we don't know if he's going to be there in January 2025. There would be people who on October the 8th, if they'd heard us talk like that, would have been astonished, because there was an assumption that surely he could not survive this epic failure on October the 7th, that it was on his watch that, as you described it, the biggest massacre in Israeli history had happened. And what this period is beginning to remind me of is that period after the Rabin assassination, which was, there's a mood in the immediate moment, which is one thing, and Netanyahu at the time was lucky that there was not an election immediately, because I think Shimon Peres would have won it instantly and big if there had been...
Shimon Peres is the one who decided not to have it instantly.
He absolutely did. Yeah, no. Peres' own vanity. He wanted to win his own mandate, and he didn't do it. But Netanyahu was very lucky. He benefited from that, because the election came a year later, and then he won. At the time, you know, I wrote in my Guardian column, Israelis must get rid of Netanyahu now. Otherwise, he will conduct the war for his own reasons that suit him, and he'll do it in a way that is bad, because he's already... left the country exposed on October the 7th. And I mentioned, you know, that the British got rid of Neville Chamberlain in 1940. You can do it even at a moment of maximum stress and pressure and national strife. In a way, that's exactly when you have to do it. And my fear was, if you didn't do it, Netanyahu, that old wily sorcerer of an operator, would find a way to stay in. Here we are, 6 months later, he's still there. Even at the point where it's even a discussion that he might be there in January. Look, I assume and hope he won't be there. But the very fact that he's held on for such a long time, I think it was a mistake. I think if Israel felt he was bore responsibility for what happened on October the 7th, it needed to get rid of him on October the 8th.
Look, the shock of the country after October 7th is something that I, in my living memory, I don't remember this kind of thing. I never went through this kind of feeling. We can look back in time and say, this could have been done differently. This should have been done differently. I think we're not yet seeing the rage. I think that what we are seeing still is the shock and the sadness, maybe the anxiety. There is a lot of talk in this country about the fact that when the war somehow settles down, when it's clear that there's not another front opening up in the north, and this week that has been a very shaky question for sure. That is when Israelis, and of course the sort of indication that Gantz himself, who really wants him and Eisenkot, really want a hostage deal. If they feel like Netanyahu isn't doing enough in that regard, they will leave the government, and that will give the sort of green light for demonstrations like we haven't seen before. I think it's a question, as you say, moods change. Is that a question? Are we still in that waiting for a protest movement like Israel's never seen? Or will it be a different kind of brick falling from the wall of this government? But we are definitely seeing the unraveling of you know, it's not dramatic yet. It's not, as I said, happening tomorrow because the Knesset will be in recess. But it's definitely a weakening, a deep weakening of the Netanyahu government.
We began our conversation talking about Joe Lieberman, who died this week, age 82. This week also saw the loss of a major Jewish figure, a winner of the Nobel Prize. Daniel Kahneman died aged 90. I very much like the line that was offered in one obituary, which said that Daniel Kahneman, you know, was often wrong, but he was always right. And what the writer of this obituary meant by that apparent paradox was that he absolutely embraced and acknowledged making mistakes. And that was part of his overall approach to how we think, that there is a necessity and a value in making mistakes, that we learn from that. So even if he made a mistake here and there, the underlying way of seeing the world was right. I felt obviously a particular reaction to his death, because you and I spoke to him not that long ago.
Yes, we did. I mean, beside his work, which awarded him the Nobel Prize, he was also an advocate of Israeli democracy. He was really concerned looking at what Israel was going through with the judicial overhaul. And he talked to us on the podcast February last year, and he warned that this is the gravest, you know, challenge that Israel is facing. Let's hear a little bit about that.
I'm not an optimist at heart. I'm genetically pessimistic. My mother was a pessimist. So I'm not an optimist. But here, during my visit in Israel, I was asking anybody, do you see it? Do you see anything, any reason for hope? And I didn't hear much. Mm-hmm. I mean, the feeling is despair, and I'm afraid that the despair may lead to inaction, and which is exactly what the government would wish. That is, people are not going to, I think, it's quite possible that the response will be inadequate to the threat. And then it will be too late.
It's quite something to hear those words now. He obviously was speaking at the height of the protests against the judicial overhaul. But there is a kind of extra resonance to those words, given everything we've been talking about today and that's been going on in recent months. So Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in 2002 for economic sciences, psychologist and leader in the field of decision-making and where that impacts in economics, has died age 90.
Yes, and everything, you know, that he worked on, particularly demonstrating how people abandon logic and leap to conclusions, I think it continues to be very relevant even now. And, you know, if you want to check out that episode, it's called Protesting Fast and Slow, where we interviewed Daniel Kahneman. Are we going to move on to our official awards, Jonathan?
I think we absolutely should. Well, before, I think you've got a nominee. I was going to do a little mention of former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who this week in London delivered the first lecture in memory of the late chief rabbi here in Britain, Lord Jonathan Sacks. We've talked about how Jonathan Sacks's sort of reputation has only grown since his death. People go to his teachings and recordings and speeches on YouTube and all kinds of other places. And this was yet another sign of the size of that legacy. But it was really Gordon Brown who just gave an absolutely spellbinding lecture, quoting but sort of expanding on Jonathan Sacks's theme that it's a country is rich when it looks after its poor. It's strong when it protects its weak. It is invulnerable when it looks out for the vulnerable. And he talked about poverty, rising poverty figures in this country, and did it with a kind of moral passion as he talked about children who don't have enough to eat, who sleep on floors where there is no floor covering in Britain now in 2024, and who don't have access to the basics in terms of hygiene and sanitation. And he did it with fervor. And I just realized listening to him how rare that is actually now in our politics here, but in many other places, that person who has almost kind of, he's the son of a preacher. And there was some of that as he honored Jonathan Sacks. So a mention for Gordon Brown, but you have a nominee for Mensch.
Yes, I think I already gave him the nomination a few weeks ago, so you'll have to forgive me. But this is Idan Amedi, who is a huge name here in Israel. He's a huge star. He's a singer and also an actor in Fauda. He was seriously wounded in combat in Gaza. After a lot of recovery, he was offered a very high reward, a very high honor, in Israel, which is to light a torch in the ceremonial torch that sort of takes Israel from Memorial Day, which is a very somber day here in this country, to Independence Day. Again, this speaks to the argument going on now in Israel, how to and if to celebrate Independence Day at all under this shadow or this dark cloud of the war. Idan Amedi receiving this high honor request to light a torch, and him saying there are others that deserve the honor more than him. He prefers to be this year at home to think about the friends he lost in the war, and that he knows it's an honor, but he would rather be honored in a different year. I think that is something that Israelis, that really resonated with them.
Yeah, and so a very strong repeat appearance in our awards ceremony for Idan Amedi. And yeah, that's getting closer, isn't it? All those moments of Memorial Day and Independence Day are looming. And as you say, they'll be very, very different this year. Shall I do the chutzpah nominee for this week?
Knock yourself out.
So a very good writer called Ian Leslie in Britain has been writing about how it's noticeable how people can have very strong feelings about subjects they don't really necessarily know all that much about. And he had noticed that particularly in the area of Israel-Palestine, you can always see vox pops of people at the demonstrations. They've become almost a little sort of form, a little meme online, where people do vox pops, where they interview people at the demonstrations against Israel, the pro-ceasefire demonstrations, and ask them, as they're chanting, from the river to the sea, for example, they'll say, do you know which river it is? And the person carrying the banner says, no. Do you know which sea it is? No. And this has become, as I say, a sort of little meme in its own right. It was, anyway, Ian Leslie, this writer, who tweeted this little bit of New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being questioned on TV about her position on the current war.
There, in terms of geopolitics and the war in the Middle East, is very different than people expressing their First Amendment right to protest.
Well, yes, but I also think that what people are starting to see, at least in the occupation of Palestine, is just an increasing crisis of humanitarian condition. And that, to me, is just where I tend to come from on this issue.
You use the term the occupation of Palestine. What did you mean by that?
I think what I meant is like the settlements that are increasing in some of these areas and places where Palestinians are experiencing difficulty in access to their housing and homes.
Do you think you can expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd also just, I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue.
I mean, good for her for admitting that she's not the expert, but it really was sort of laid a bit bare. And like I say, she's not the only one. If people can express, you know, heartfelt views, strongly held, where the factual basis is a little sketchy. Let's be kind.
Yeah, I think it maybe says something about the beginning of our conversation, understanding why Israel has become so criticized by the international community. To me, you know, as spending most of my life interviewing people, it's funny how you try and ask these very difficult questions, you know, like, sir, you said this in 2015, but then since you've said this and that contradict, and the sort of intelligence of the interviewer here to say, what do you mean by that? Could you expand on that? It's a very simple, seemingly innocuous question, but it exposes what lies pretty bare here, which is you need to know a little bit more when you talk about the conflict the way that you do.
Yeah. So worthy winners for our awards this week. And remember, spread the word far and wide about Unholy if you are enjoying what we're doing.
And we will say our thank yous to Gaia Glaser, Omer Primat, and Omri Barak. And we shall meet next week, Jonathan.
See you then.